That's Miles Davis with All Blues from his 1959 album, Kind of Blue. Some great sidemen on this album, including Bill Evans on piano, Wynton Kelly also on piano, Jimmy Cobb on drums, Paul Chambers on bass, John Coltrane on tenor sax, and Julian Cannonball Adderley on alto. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, November the 24th, and the grand jury marathon continues in Ferguson, Missouri, without a decision. And Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, the only Republican in President Obama's cabinet, has resigned. Flags are flying at half-mast in Washington, D.C. to mark the death yesterday morning of Marion Barry, who, without question, was the city's most popular, controversial, criticized, powerful, and yet beloved mayor. He was 78 years old. Barry, a four-term mayor of the district from 1979 to 1991 and from 1995 to 1999, was the eighth ward's representative in the city council when he died, bringing to an end more than 40 tumultuous years in civil rights struggle and public life. Even a federal conviction and six-month prison sentence on drug use charges in 1990 did not end his political career, as was clearly intended. Historian, political researcher, and commentator Dr. Randy Short joins us now to discuss the significance and legacy of Washington, D.C.'s self-described Mayor for Life, part of the title of Barry's recently published autobiography, Mayor for Life, The Incredible Story of Marion Barry, Jr. And with that, Randy, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Sister Lee. I'm honored that you called me and asked me to participate in giving some words about the honorable, we call the mayor, Marion Stepanoff Barry.
Yes, we will get to that very interesting middle name there. But could you talk first about your family's roots in Washington, D.C., and the connection to Marion Barry?
Succinctly, my people, through my mother's line, are the Piscataqua. They are a black Indian group that had been in the Washington area for thousands of years before there was a Washington. And as the first census, my mother's European ancestors, not through consent but by coercion, the Lancasters. The Lancasters are the British Catholic Plantagenet dynasty that got the land called Maryland, and from which, out of Maryland, came Washington County, which is what made Washington, D.C.
And how was your family connected to Marion Barry? How did that come about?
Well, very simply, my grandfather and my grandmother, but she was basically gone before Barry moved to the city, were activists. My grandfather, in the 30s, shot and killed the sheriff's son of Rocky Mount, North Carolina, and had to flee the country and then settled in Washington. And just was an activist in the NAACP. My great-grandfather's in the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. There's a little bit of Garveyism. And my grandparents were the black folks who ran the very first housing project called Langston Terrace, built by black architects by the Roosevelts in the 1930s. So my grandfather, James Nathaniel Short Sr., was basically the mayor of River Terrace, Carver Terrace, and Langston Terrace. That meant thousands of black people trusted him, and he directed their votes. He was someone who ran and won, although the elections were stolen from him, as a black Republican. In addition to that, my grandfather was such a powerful figure. he forced the National Symphony Orchestra to perform in the ghetto because they didn't want to be at the National Symphony Orchestra around white people. That's my grandfather. So when Mr. Berry came to Washington in 1965, my grandfather is also a Mason, among other things. He was someone to go see. And my grandfather blessed him, Catfish Mayfield, and other people who also grew up with my uncles to get involved.
Okay. I wanted to say, of course, that you, part of your dissertation was an early history of Washington, D.C. The city is mourning today. What exactly are they mourning in the death of Marion Barry?
Well, my thesis, my master's thesis, not my doctoral dissertation, was called Apartheid in Washington or something like that, and it was looking at the history of blacks in Washington, D.C. from 1800 to 1865. There are two Washingtons. There's a white Washington and there's a black Washington. I'm certain black Washington is in mourning. A white Washington who have a white settler mentality, who want everything that's here pushed away, they may not shed a tear at all. But what many of us are crying is that there once was a chocolate city, and now we may as well call this French vanilla. When Marion Barry was mayor, could get a job. I got my first job through Marion Barry. There was an effort to lift up black people, which Marion Barry was able to get his hands on the coffers of the city and give that to people who had been excluded. Washington, D.C., has always been a city of massive contradictions, and the kind of racial segregation in Washington paralleled any place in South Africa. And Marion Barry forced white people to step back and help black people step up. He came and made people, the first time we ever had anyone, teach us to stand up and fight back. Marion Barry got on the school board in the late 60s. And by the 70s, he was there. No, I'm sorry, early 70s, he was on the school board. You need to know, the same school board many years before had allowed a white pedophile by the name of Herman Benelot Moens to molest, at his own estimation, and I'm talking about oral sodomy, 5,000 black females. So for him to get on the school board all these years later and defy people and to put black history and to fight for black teachers' dignity, no one had really stood up. We have a very strong, assimilated, light-skinned, arrogant, aloof elite that had sub-managed African Americans for the benefit of whites and for their own selfish class interests, and Barry smashed that.
What was the antecedent of Marion Barry in terms of local government?
We had an Uncle Tom guy by the name of Walter Washington. He was the kind of hat in your hand black person that white folk could trust. And black folks were told, well, that's the best you can do. You have to understand that Marion, Washington, Walter Washington, and then almost 100 years before, it was Boss Shepherd. He was a white man who looked out for black people and poor white people. And like Marion Barry, he was jailed, and people still voted him in as mayor. And so the white racist apartheid D.C. council or D.C. committee that Congress has, you need to understand, when Washington was established in 1800, it's in the Constitution that the Congress has exclusive legislative control over Washington, which means we're the only people in the country who don't determine our destiny. And so if there's a mayor that can touch the lives of people and help the poor that are here, normally these racist people come down and strip of power the mayor and jail him. And so it's not just a black thing, because it happened to Boss Shepherd in the 1860s, 70s. It happened to Marion Barry, too. Walter Washington was to be the handkerchief hand type black person, because you have to understand, many people are not aware. They always talk about the riots in the 60s starting in Watts. And in reality, the first major race riot in America in the 60s occurred in Washington, D.C. in 1961, followed by the riot in Birmingham, and then the one that occurred on August 11th in Watts. So they put a black face on the control of the city because Washington, about 1960, became one of the most densely populated black cities in the country. And Washington, you need to also understand, for many years, for 60 years, until 1920, had the largest single urban black community in the United States.
When you say that these riots occurred, what were the riots about?
The riots were about, a lot of people think Washington, D.C. is an easy place. It is not. As I speak to you, having grown up here, when I was growing up, roughly 40% of all black men were in jail, were under supervision of the courts or on probation. You had a 1 in 20 chance of being shot to death before you were 30. The level of poverty for most blacks is about 30% or more. The level of poverty for children runs about 50%. I grew up with people whose main concern was not being eaten by rats when they slept, within the shadow of the Capitol. And the blacks who were successful, like the Negroes at Howard University, didn't give one damn about what happened to the poor, darker African Americans. And of course, the whites were very aggressive. And what happened at the stadium during the sports event, I guess some black kids and white kids started fighting, and the black kids beat the hell out of the white kids. And this was covered up because this was at the height of the Cold War. Who would think, and the so-called capital democracy, that you have blacks and whites having open warfare? And again, we need to go back a little. The most violent race riot in the United States in the summer of 1919 was in Chicago. It was here in Washington, D.C., where blacks engaged in a level of urban warfare so sophisticated, these documents remain sealed by the military intelligence agency, where blacks kill, for every black kill, we kill four whites. Things are very tense here.
Well, I want to talk about the Marion Barry who came to Washington, D.C. Who was that man?
Marion Barry was the son of a sharecropper. His mother basically was, you know, a domestic, born in Itabena, Mississippi. Father died when he was four. His mother moved the family to Memphis, which is like the capital of the Mississippi Delta region. She married a black man. I think he was a butcher. Marion Barry did all kinds of things to help his family, pick cotton, sold newspapers, bagged groceries. He was very bright, got into the black school in Memphis called Lemoyne Owens as a chemistry major, was a very good student in chemistry. On top of that, he had joined the NAACP and became president of the NAACP and the school where he attended. Later, he's one of the founding members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee that met at Shaw University with Reverend Martin Luther King in 1960 and was the first chairman of this very dynamic group called SNCC. He was involved in all the movements, Mississippi, you name it. And he came to Washington, D.C. in 1965, June of 1965, if I'm correct. And when he came here, a lot of people recognized that D.C. was as southern as Jackson, Mississippi.
And what did he do when he came to Washington, D.C.?
He began protesting, and he brought a crew of people from down south and other activists, people like Ivanhoe Donaldson, and they sought to take power in the city. The very same things that they had done with the Freedom Democratic Mississippi Party, with Fannie Lou Hamer and the other people, they implemented the lessons that they had learned in Atlantic City to try to take power in the city, and they succeeded within 12 years.
When was his first foray into politics?
One of the things that
elective
he did,
politics, I should say, elective
well,
office.
Well, elective politics. I think the first thing he got was on the school board. Marion Barry was known for wearing dashikis and not mincing his tongue talking to people about racism and injustice. He was very popular with people. He had a way with young people. Prior to him getting in politics, he had a program called Pride, where they had people collecting garbage and improving the sanitation. Like I said, we had a major problem where children would die of rat fever from rat bites or rat fecal matter or whatever being in people's food. That's how bad the rats are. They still are here if you come. Barry got thousands of people employment, and they built their dignity, and that became his machine, Pride. And he, with Mary Treadwell, I believe his first wife, these people built a machine that gave dignity. And you need to understand that Marion Barry in particular became even more powerful once Martin Luther King was assassinated. Washington, D.C. had the worst riot that occurred in the aftermath of the assassination of Martin Luther King on April 4th, 1968. Even more whites fled the city. The situation became more grave, and he was able, because of Pride, to step into that vacuum, and he went from one thing to the other. In fact, he was one of the people on the Civilian Review Board to challenge the police, who used to just kill people because they were black here. It's old. I mean, you just crack people's skulls. This is old. It's not just Ferguson. It's here, too.
And then when did he make a move toward higher office? When did he decide that it was time to basically govern the city?
I think they came in with the plan to get it, but they wanted to build. To, you know, Marion Barry was not one of these selfish, self-centered, what I call black neck leaders, selfish, self-centered, middle-class black who wants to aspire. Socialized work and privatized gain when that office. Marion Barry created a movement, and that movement was his catapult into electoral office. The school board was the first place that he went. I think that's about 1970. And then from there, he got the mayoralty in 1978. We need to remember that Marion Barry was, I believe, a city councilman. He got a position somewhere on the council, if I'm correct. And during that time, Marion Barry was shot, almost killed, when the Hanafi Muslims took over Bernay Brith, the city hall, the city council building, and one other building. Just so you'll know the context, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar bought a house on 16th Street. And a group of Muslims, some say connected rogue drug-dealing members, somehow affiliated with the Nation of Islam, came and butchered. By the way, my aunt and uncle and my cousins were supposed to be in the house. They just happened not to be there. They chopped up three women and four babies and put them in a bathtub. And nothing was done about it. So these people went in shooting and took power. Marion Barry was almost killed. He survived. And after being shot within an inch of his heart, was back at his desk in 30 days. A lot of people were impressed by this. So when he ran for mayor against Sterling Tucker, one of the light-skinned type people from the Urban League, and of course he was also running against Clifford Alexander, another one of these light-skinned folk, people in D.C., if you understand here, we have a real problem with people thinking that they're cute because they're part white. I mean, it's horrible here. In fact, one of the things that Marion Barry had to do when he married Effie, she's related to the Grahams, the Jews who used to own the Washington Post. That helped him win because she's light-skinned, because a lot of people wouldn't have voted for Barry because he's too dark. They'll figure.
You know, it's a really incredible story, but, you know, we hear this all over the place, in Atlanta, in Virginia, in Baltimore, Maryland.
It's much worse here. Ever since Barry left, all the mayors have either been half white or light skinned. This one now, I guess she's not that, but then she's gay. I mean, but you can't be too black, too strong. Sharon Pratt Kelly can pass for white. Anthony Williams is half white. Fenty is half white. All three of them gay, we suspect. And then this new one now. And I'm sorry, Mayor Gray, he can pass for white.
So this is a problem in Washington, D.C.?
Hell yes.
Why?
My father and mother went to my mother went to Dunbar, like Gray did, like Edward Brooke. That was for the light-skinned people. The blacks go to the darker-skinned blacks go to the dark-skinned schools. Howard University, up until 1970, you had to send a picture. If you were too dark, you might not get accepted. You mean talk about apartheid? We got it here, within our community and outside. We have it both ways.
And Marion Barry was mayor for four terms. What would you say were the major accomplishments of his four terms in office?
Say that again, because there's noise in the background. I'm sorry.
Marion Barry was mayor for four terms, from 79 to 91 and from 95 to 99. What would you say were the major accomplishments of his four terms?
Marion Barry did many things. One of the greatest things that he may never get credit for is he revitalized Washington, D.C. as a major city. I mean, there was incredible building and construction that redefined Washington. The metro was put in under Washington. It never happened under all the white control from before. Marion Barry opened up the civil service. Tens of thousands of blacks got good-paying jobs, whether people liked how he got it or not. Marion Barry was a person that promoted black pride. It's an intangible, but you felt like you belonged here. Marion Barry's effort, he demanded and he got one-third or more of all the contracts of the city had to go to blacks or you wouldn't get it. He wouldn't do it for you. You couldn't pay him. He wasn't for himself. Marion Barry created more black millionaires than anybody in history, more than anybody. I mean, all the development people see out in Prince George's County, these blacks with these palatial homes, Marion Barry did that. Nobody else. And Marion Barry faced the wrath and the hatred of white people, but he built up black folks, made people rich. And he put black people, and I don't just mean, I have to emphasize this, it used to be you were light-skinned or you didn't get anything. Marion Barry allowed people who were black of all colors to have opportunities. He created the Summer Youth Program, which introduced, he put folks in jobs. He demanded that black people get jobs downtown that had never been open to them. The economic gift alone, I could go on and on, but he helped bring other people up. He truly served the people.
But he was not without flaws. We do have, in fact, there were charges of corruption that plagued his administration. And then we know that in 1990...
But not him personally. Marion Barry, drug problem, yes. Sex... At least it was women, yes. But did he personally steal anything? They never got him for one dime. And he's probably died a pauper. Marion Barry made a lot of other people around him. Maybe they took, but he wasn't putting, he didn't worship money. It's a lie. In fact, Marion Barry was struggling his last few years. I mean, in fact, the very same blacks that made him rich turned their backs on him when the whites began to dog him, the kind of hypocrisy in our community. Forgive me, I'm getting angry.
Well, we don't need that. We need you to be a historian at the moment.
Yeah, I'm being historical, but I'm just saying to you, when you hear just drugs and corruption, that's a lie. There's more corruption now. The house that I'm in, and the other house that my mother has, and the house that white folks stole from my father that's worth it. There's more corruption now in Washington than when there was Barry, people putting up houses that don't meet codes. If let us have an earthquake, watch how many people will die here. when the pipes don't work and the infrastructure is in many ways worse now than when he was in. It may look gleaming and nice. The kind of racial discrimination in employment here, I mean, we're going to talk about corruption. Whose corruption? You mean when someone black does something wrong, we get upset about it? When whites do worse, well, they're white. So, yes, there were these things. Yes, there were people who stole. But the people who stole the most, who never went to jail, are the white developers and the whites who've gotten the most out of this. The black folks, bit players. The entire time Marion Barry was mayor, the way that they set the tax assessment in the city, they overtaxed blacks to subsidize white development. Did anybody in the billions of dollars taken from us go to jail? Never one. And they're going to talk about someone getting a ticket or going. Of course I don't want them to do that. But, I mean, relative to, say, Chicago or New York or, for that matter, Atlanta, minuscule. Marion Barry, we need to understand, came to this city with J. Edgar Hoover and COINTELPRO on his heels. And the only thing that they busted Barry for, let's be real, my family knew the family, the girl that he was with. Eric Holder spent $40 million plus dollars to get Marion Barry entrapped. Eric Holder, this devil who's attorney general, I can't wait until he leaves. He threatened to take the children away from this lady, and she'd never see them again if she didn't get Marion Barry to use drugs. That's the story they won't tell you. Can you imagine if I had children, I didn't want to lose them? I just might set you up, too, at all costs. So people don't talk about that. And Washington, D.C., of course, is home to the FBI. They were after Marion Barry and tried to get him for years. And in reality, it wasn't Marion Barry that they were after. They were after all of us. They just happened to use his weaknesses to destroy this black community in the city.
Well, we want to leave it there for today, but it was a good thing to just get a background of the apartheid state of affairs in Washington, D.C., that Marion Barry came and met and left yesterday.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Randy Short, for being with us today.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
We'll take this break and come back and talk about the subject that we've all been waiting to talk about. We're talking about rape, race, credibility, and justice right after this. Listening to PRN.FM, I'm Eutrice Lead. The program is Lead Stories. Entertainer Bill Cosby ended his sold-out gig in Melbourne, Florida, on Friday with a standing ovation from adoring fans. Within the industry and in the court of public opinion, however, there's nothing to cheer about. An ever-growing list of women, most of them white, have come forward alleging that he had drugged and sexually assaulted or raped them, and although their claims date back as many as 50 years in one case, they are gaining traction as having credibility, even though there was no proof. Exactly 27 years ago today, a 15-year-old girl on her way home from school vanished without a trace. She was pulled into a car by white men who took her to a remote location, drugged her, and for 4 days gang raped her, she said. She was semi-conscious when found next to a trash container in an apartment complex. Tawana Brawley's claim was dismissed as a hoax. Similarly, Nafissatou Diallo, an immigrant from Guinea, found herself the target of prosecution when the Sofitel housekeeper alleged that IMF chief Dominique Strauss-Kahn had sexually assaulted her in his hotel suite in 2011. Prosecutor Cyrus Vance Jr. himself asked a judge to dismiss charges against Strauss-Kahn because Diallo lacked credibility. Strauss-Kahn later settled. So we want to talk about the obvious race-based dichotomy in terms of who is credible. I talked about the Brawley case because I covered this case extensively, and as I said, today is 27 years to the day that she came forward with charges, and automatically the tables were turned against her. She had absolutely no credibility, and therefore she was not entitled to justice. The only thing that Tawana Brawley had been asking for, even up until this day, is a trial of her attackers. But no credibility. She has no credibility. A lot of effort went into producing a bogus report from a so-called special grand jury that said she was, in fact, she had committed a hoax. And to this day, she is paying the price for it. As is her lawyer, Alton Maddox, who has not been disbarred, but was barred. It is the first time I've ever heard of it, and most people have ever heard of a legislature barring a lawyer from the court. So the price also was paid by her attorney. Nafissatou Diallo came forward and said she was attacked. There was proof, there was evidence, independent corroborative evidence. But she was the one who was put on trial by none other than the prosecutor. Never mind the fact that Dominique Strauss-Kahn had in fact faced charges, sexual assault and rape charges in France and in Washington, D.C., and was actually convicted of sexual assault and aggravated pimping. He was a procurer of women for sex orgies, in which, of course, he enthusiastically participated. But he is the head of the IMF. He has credibility. And so the person bringing the charge went on trial in the court of public opinion and with the prosecutor who should have been training his eyes on the attacker, instead demanding that the judge throw out charges against Strauss-Kahn because he said the complainant lacked credibility. Now, the situation with Cosby is very distasteful, and the stories that we are hearing are very troubling, and they should concern anybody. However, we see that even with the passage of time, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, and in one case, 50 years after these alleged attacks, these women get automatic credibility. They're now credible. And I bring to your attention that in not one case so far did we have any evidence produced. We have no charges filed. We have no record of corroboration. They just came forward. And they are believed. And now the media is in a supportive role, saying, yes, we believe these things happened. The statute of limitations has passed, but that doesn't matter. The fact is, they, based on the mere statements of these women, most of whom are white, and that is a factor because we'll get to that in a minute, based on their statements, credibility automatically is assigned to them. And that's fine. But it doesn't work out for a Tawana Brawley. And it doesn't work out for a Nafissatou Diallo. And we have to ask why. The same media that today is demanding that Bill Cosby essentially pay for these, and they've decided these are real crimes. The court of public opinion, irrespective of the law and its application in his specific case, the court of public opinion has decided these women are credible. Their charges, therefore, are credible. And what they say is as good as evidence. Again, no corroborative proof, no actions taken legally, no complaints filed, no reports with the police, nothing to really support their claim. We have only their word, for the most part. That's what we have, their word. It points, their word points out a troubling and consistent pattern, but it nonetheless is their word. In the Brawley case, you had witnesses, you had the victim herself, you had independent corroborative proof, you had medical records, you had all kinds of things. You had investigations that were done, and still, absolutely not credible. Not credible. And why was she not credible? A 15-year-old black girl, all of her assailants were white men, she said. And there was no way that the state was going to allow this case to take shape. Because, of course, apart from the fact that among her attackers was, her alleged attackers, I would say, was a district, an assistant district attorney, Stephen Pagonis, and a part-time police officer, Harry Crist, who in the course of this case mysteriously turns up dead. It was initially ruled a suicide, but a medical examiner years later said, no, this was a homicide. It was rumored that Harry Crist was getting a bit, having pangs of conscience and was looking as if he was going to talk. And that was at the time that he turned up dead. So the question is, how do we explain this dichotomy? How do we explain it? Why is the word of a black girl and a black woman, why is it that there's such a problem with their credibility when it comes to sexual harassment, sexual assault, and rape charges when their alleged victimizers are white men? I am not seeking here to exonerate Bill Cosby at all. I'm saying what the facts are. We have a situation where women are coming forward and people are now, the same media that excoriated Ms. Diallo and Tawana Brawley, are the ones now embracing all of this, this groundswell of accusation, without even demanding the slightest bit of proof. Without demanding something that says, well, you know, I hear what you're saying, but what do you have to support your charges? How could you possibly make these charges 30 and 40 and 50 years from the date you said these things happened, but you expect them to have the weight of a criminal indictment? And surprisingly, they now do. They now do. Now, that is something that we should take a look at, don't you think? So I pause on this day because it is a significant day. 27 years since this young girl had made this charge. 27 years since she has been demanding a trial. And this is an odd thing. If this young girl, 15-year-old, had committed something of a hoax, why would she be so insistent on a trial? Wouldn't you think somebody like that would be running and hiding and trying to avoid any further public attention? And what she has been insisting on is what is supposedly her right, the right to a trial. But instead, we had the state attorney general perpetrate really the hoax here. We had the system deciding she was just not going to get that. Why? It would have been the first time that a black female might have been successful in getting a conviction against a white male sexual attacker. And nobody wanted to have the responsibility for that. In the case of Nasifatu Diallo, the prosecutor, supposedly a liberal guy, son of Cyrus Vance, U.S. Attorney General, big time. But none other than the district attorney himself decided that automatic credibility will go to the white guy, the rich white guy, the powerful white guy. And speaking of which, here we have a good comparison with how Bill Clinton is treated as a sexual felon, fully rehabilitated, and is the darling of the media. Nobody ever introduces Bill Clinton as a guy who was impeached for lying about having sexual relations with an intern. He is fully rehabilitated, no stench to him whatsoever. And one wonders, how come this it works this way? Do we not have laws that go straight across the board that apply to everybody equally and so forth? This is a very important question. So, in as much as the media are very, very enthusiastic and have decided that the charges, just as charges, allegations, just as allegations, have the full force of corroborative proof and validity and credibility, I asked them to explain why for 27 years a black female has been waiting for justice in a case that met all of the requirements for further investigation, for indictments, and for trial. And that hasn't happened yet. In fact, they're making her pay for defaming her alleged attacker. They punished her family by making them basically seek refuge in a church in Brooklyn, promising to, they issued warrants for their arrest for not cooperating with a clearly corrupt investigation. Their lawyer was punished and still is, making a very kind of weird history in America as the longest sentence of disbarment. But again, he's not disbarred. He holds the record for not being able to practice law, but for no reason other than he was stridently defending the little black girl, 15 years old, on these charges. And he continues to do that at great personal and professional expense. I find that really reprehensible. And although today David Carr in the New York Times writes a chest-beating piece about how, you know, an act of contrition for ignoring these women's claims and instead writing a fluff piece about Bill Cosby and ignoring the question of the lingering charges that are now mounting against him, he writes that he really confesses that he didn't do the right thing. He should have done the right thing as a journalist and all of that. But the same paper, the New York Times, was only too happy to report that Tawana Brawley had committed a hoax. And every time that she's mentioned, the word hoax attaches. And her charges still have not gone before a court. Her attackers have not been brought to justice. And this is not whether you believe she's telling the truth or not telling the truth. The irony here is that the simplest thing about this whole trial is to find out who is telling the truth. It's the simplest thing to establish. If there were a trial, you could tell in a second who is telling the truth and who's not telling the truth. But for 27 years, almost three decades, this then 15-year-old young girl has had to grow up and live. She's now a mother with the stain on her reputation as a liar, as a person who maligned the reputation of squeaky clean white men and who was caught and therefore is being punished for it. So I raise the question again. Again, we will talk about Mr. Cosby, but I'm talking about the credibility that automatically attaches depending on your race. It is so clear. It is so clear. We just heard Dr. Randy Short talk about Washington in a what many would consider to be a startlingly race-related way. But that was the reality. It is the reality of life. And because people don't know about it, they don't understand the depth of feeling about it. They don't understand what it is to live in a society where there are two sets of rules. The people of Ferguson, everybody's hoping, my God, we hope they don't erupt. But life, as Richard Rothstein of the Economic Policy Institute told us in discussing how the Fergusons of America were shaped by public policy strictly on the basis of race to create this bifurcation, this duality, this schizophrenic nature of life that permeates all sectors of our lives. Simply because you're oblivious to it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, and that it is resonating very profoundly with people. The Brawley case is one of them. 27 years of injustice, and all that was asked for is a trial. And the world would see who is telling the truth and who is lying. And the state decided she doesn't have the credibility. She doesn't have credibility. Do you know, as I wrap up here, I had an interview with the Attorney General, the then Attorney General, Robert Abrams. And he was telling me how difficult it was to prosecute this case because Tawana Brawley had stopped cooperating and the family had stopped cooperating. And I said, well, let me ask you, are you saying that, let's suppose she was dead. You're saying that you couldn't bring a case because the person is dead? He said to me, it would have been better if she were dead. I'm not making that up. He said those words to me, and I printed them verbatim. And such is the attitude of the state that is permitted to go on and on and on because the likely targets of prosecution are not the people doing the bad things, but the people who are filing the complaints against them. Well, that brings us to the end of my program today. I hope it brought to your attention something that is useful. Let me know. You can send me a note at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Wake Up Call with Richard Martin. As always, a pleasure and a great, great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow.